Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in this hour, Appalachian columnist James Branscombe with a vision for Eastern Kentucky that returns to the people the means to build a new economy and the land to build it on. And Chris Begley has a new book about preparing for disasters. First, growth in big data centers that support artificial intelligence has been accelerating, catching communities off guard. Despite heavy backlash, a massive 1.6 million square foot data center has been approved for West Louisville. Several cities and counties, buying time to get on top of the situation, now have temporary bans on accepting and processing data center permits. Lexington is among those, and we'll have more on that later in the hour. What does a prospective data center host community need to know? Ashley Wilms is executive director at the Kentucky Resources Council, where they've come up with model local regulations and proposed state legislation. Welcome, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
First, what prompted KRC to develop these resources now?
Well, for more than 40 years, Kentucky Resources Council has really been a trusted source of free legal representation and assistance to individuals and local governments and grassroots organizations on environmental and energy issues impacting our state. So when communities first started hearing about these data center projects, they reached out. There's no state or federal framework that specifically addresses the regulation and siting of data centers in Kentucky. These data centers are regulated, if at all, under a patchwork of local ordinances and general state regulations that mostly predate the hyperscale boom. So we just realized that these resources were needed, and we've been working to develop tools to help communities that are grappling with whether to allow data centers. And if they do, how those data centers can be responsibly sited and regulated to protect the environment, public health, and the rights of neighboring landowners.
It feels like this has been kind of mushrooming over recent weeks. Are you seeing a wave of data center proposals, or is this more about helping communities prepare before decisions are made?
We are already seeing a wave of proposals. In fact, we've been saying lately, it feels like all data centers all the time. Data centers have been proposed in Jefferson, Oldham, Mason, Mercer, Simpson, Boyd, and Hancock counties. Others have been floated in McCracken County and even in Bell County to the east. There's a proposed 2,000-acre campus recently approved by the fiscal court in Mason County. And as you mentioned already, the campground road facility in Louisville, which has already started construction.
Well, the Kentucky Resources Council's model zoning ordinance is meant for communities that already have planning and zoning. So what are the main protections or review steps that the ordinance would put in place?
So for counties with planning and zoning, our model ordinance recommends and requires a conditional use permit, in addition to limiting the location of data centers to a new category of industrial zones. We think that this flexibility of a conditional use permit allows the local county to craft case-specific conditions as are necessary to integrate a data center project into the existing environment while protecting the rights of neighboring landowners and others. The conditional use permit in the model ordinance would be issued by the Planning Commission in conjunction with the rezoning to this new industrial classification for data centers.
That's kind of what is happening in Lexington.
It does sound that way. Lexington has recently imposed a temporary moratorium on data centers while they are developing a new zoning ordinance to address data centers.
Now, you've also created a model home rule ordinance for counties that don't have comprehensive planning and zoning. How common is that situation in Kentucky, and what can counties do when they don't already have full zoning framework set up?
Less than half of Kentucky's 120 counties have adopted both planning and zoning. So home rule cities and counties can't do land use planning or limit data centers to particular zones, but they can use general home rule powers that are found in our statutes that authorize county ordinances for abatement of public nuisances, conservation of natural resources, and regulation of commerce for public protection. So our home rule ordinance requires a construction or operation permit issued by the fiscal court with standards that assure certain conditions, consideration and avoidance, mitigation of impacts to other properties, again, to ensure that neighboring lands aren't impacted and that the rights of the community are more safeguarded. So we have these two ordinances, both of which are available on our website at kyrc.org/data centers, one for counties with planning and zoning and one for home rule counties.
Well, for a county judge executive, a planning commissioner, a fiscal court member, or a resident who's just finding out that a data center is being proposed nearby, what are the first questions they ought to ask before a project moves too far down the road?
Well, I will say my inbox has been filled in the past few months with these kinds of questions from local residents and community groups, even local officials, asking things like, you know, can data centers be built next to my child's school or my residential neighborhood? How noisy will they be? Will they increase my energy bill? And what about water usage and air pollution from on-site power generation and backup generators? But the big question is, you know, how can my city or county regulate where a data center is located or how it operates? And can we ban them if we don't want them here?
Well, your proposed state legislation would bring larger data center projects into a siting board review process that's similar to what applies to power plants or transmission lines. What gap in the current law is that proposal trying to fill?
There really is no state or federal framework that specifically addresses the regulation of data centers in Kentucky. And behind the meter power plants built for data centers are exempt from the Public Service Commission review and state siting board review because they don't sell power to the grid. So aside from local approvals where they're applicable, you know, the only permits, even for these on-site power generating facilities, are the permits required by, you know, like state permits for air and water pollution. So, you know, we really feel like there needs to be a state level framework for regulating these data centers. So we drafted a bill that would assure this baseline review for data centers proposals over a certain threshold. And this would amend existing law regulating merchant power plants and transmission lines to include a requirement that data centers obtain a construction certificate from the Kentucky State Board on Electric Generation and Transmission Siting. So basically, facilities that consume a power plant's worth of electricity should get the same level of review that a merchant power plant gets. That's what our proposed bill does. And we didn't see it get off the ground this legislative session, but we're going to be pushing for legislation in 2027.
A major concern in your materials is electricity demand. And I wonder if you could help us understand the scale of that. When a data center is described in hundreds of megawatts, what does that mean, Ashley, for utilities, for ratepayers, and for the grid, for that matter, its ability to handle it?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, energy impacts really are one of the biggest concerns about these massive projects. And there are data centers powered by renewable energy. Google's upcoming Minnesota data center is going to be powered by, I think, 1.6 gigawatts of wind and solar and have, I think, 300 megawatts of battery storage. But, you know, most are being powered by fossil fuels. And we're seeing utilities pointing to this new surge in projected load growth in proposing new gas plants and even extending the lives of aging and uneconomic coal-fired power plants. So these are big questions that we're looking at in Kentucky and elsewhere. You know, fueling and cooling these hyperscale data centers requires unprecedented amounts of energy. In fact, as you mentioned, facility size is usually measured in electricity use. A single modern AI data center can use as much power as a small city, you know, 100,000 homes. The Campground Road facility in Louisville has requested 525 megawatts. For comparison, the Cane Run generating station capacity is 691 megawatts. The Mason County proposal is reported at 1.2 to 2 gigawatts. But they get even bigger. There's a project in Pennsylvania that is projected at 4.4 gigawatts, which is enough to power all the homes in greater Philadelphia.
Wow, That's incredible. Considering the consumption of these data centers, is this pushing us more toward renewables?
Unfortunately, what we're seeing right now is that most of the projects we're looking at are relying on fossil fuels. We've seen in other places more reliance on renewables. And, you know, that certainly should be part of the equation here in Kentucky. Because as we're considering some of these questions, like particularly cost to ratepayers, we do have to consider how we are producing electricity here in Kentucky. Again, there's been some talk about even keeping aging coal-fired power plants online to meet the demand for new data centers. And unfortunately, in Kentucky, we've seen new legislation in the past couple of years that is aimed at slowing the growth of clean, renewable energy. But a recent independent analysis that KRC actually commissioned of Kentucky's electric utility systems shows that accelerating investments in renewable energy, battery storage, and efficiency could save Kentuckians a few billion dollars through 2050 while maintaining reliable electricity supplies across the state. So I think all of these issues have to be considered together, especially as we're considering adding so much new load growth.
In at least some of the communities where data centers are being proposed, local elected officials have signed non-disclosure agreements with the companies looking to build the centers. And there's been a lot of public pushback about that, questioning the effects of NDAs on transparency, disclosure of conflicts, open meetings obligations, public records laws, and recusal when personal financial interests are involved. What's your take on these NDAs? I mean, they're not uncommon in economic development endeavors, but in this case, we're talking about something that has enormous impact.
No, you're right. And we're seeing that, that in some cases, companies come in and they ask these local leaders to sign non-disclosure agreements, and local residents are finding out about these projects at the 11th hour. And so these NDAs are preventing officials from speaking openly about these projects to the very citizens they represent. It's definitely a huge concern. And a bill in this past legislative session would have prohibited local officials from signing NDA with data center developers. It didn't pass, but it highlights why this issue is so important. And hopefully we'll see that get taken up again next year. My view is that an NDA signed by a public official in their official role should be considered a public record, even if certain portions could be redacted. But we're definitely seeing these get used and then these backroom conversations happening and citizens not being engaged about these projects until they're already in motion, which really does a disservice, I think, to the community as a whole.
Well, you know, as I mentioned in the beginning, this is coming on so suddenly and so broadly across the Commonwealth. It's caught a lot of communities flat-footed, just not prepared at all to deal with the issue. There seems to be a certain amount of inevitability. We're going to get data centers in Kentucky. Maybe not as many as are proposed, but we're going to get them. What would responsible data center development look like in Kentucky from your perspective?
Yeah, well, I think first, wherever these facilities are located, data centers should be built with community engagement from the very beginning, with the support of the community and with tangible community benefits. They should be self-contained in terms of protecting other land uses and the environment, not impose costs on other ratepayers. They should incorporate mitigation and efficiency and ideally green renewable resources for power. You know, as you mentioned, data centers are coming. I also think there's going to be a bust following this obsession with building so much capacity for this large load to service these AI data centers. So we really want to be sure that ratepayers and communities and our local environment don't bear the costs that should be placed on developers and investors. I think how we do that is through smart planning and enforceable standards. So there's an opportunity for community concerns to be addressed from the very beginning and to ensure that this growth doesn't come at the expense of Kentucky's families and waterways or future generations. So, you know, really, I think the first step is developing a zoning or siting ordinance for data centers and for communities to start having these conversations now before a data center is proposed.
Are you kind of hearing echoes of the dot-com bubble?
Well, a little bit. But I do think there's just this race by, Google and Meta and other developers to get their big AI models online. So the problem here is that it is, Kentucky's ratepayers and communities that may be left paying for the costs.
That's Ashley Wilms. She's Executive Director of the Kentucky Resources Council. Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you, Tom.
Lexington woke up one recent morning to the news that a data center would be locating on the old Lexmark site. While the news came as a surprise to city officials, the city has moved quickly to take control of the situation. WEKU's Curtis Tate gets details from City Planning Commissioner Keith Horn.
Welcome, Keith. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
So this is a really interesting time in Kentucky for data centers because it just seems like, man, these proposals are popping up everywhere all of a sudden. Why is this happening?
I don't know that I can speak exactly to why, but it seems like the capital and the profit from them is the main driving force for the data centers. Now, I would perhaps compare it to cell phones, and in the days that cell phones became ubiquitous, everyone was building cell towers and communities were concerned about that. But everyone wanted their cell service, but they didn't necessarily want cell towers. I'm kind of comparing that to data centers. Everyone is wanting and dependent on their data now, but these data centers have significant impacts on services, environmental, et cetera. So it's a difficult balance, I think, to reach. And land use. These hyperscale data centers use a lot of land.
Well, I think we can talk about the guardrails in a second that might be necessary to protect communities. But the legislature enacted some incentives to encourage data center development in Kentucky. But they did so, it seems, before a lot of communities were able to act on their own to enact their own guardrails. So did the legislature kind of leave communities to fend for themselves, in a sense?
I want to say yes, but it also seemed to spring up fairly quickly in terms of how it has become so emerging in nearly every community. So I don't know if it's fair to say that they left localities alone, but there may have been, for some part of our legislature at the state and federal level, that they don't necessarily want localities mingling in this land use for data centers, that they want to encourage them and incentivize them, perhaps because of the potential revenue involved.
But to be clear, the General Assembly didn't enact any restrictions on how cities and counties can regulate data center development. West Virginia did that. I was there when that happened. But I don't think Kentucky did that.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Well, one thing that just happened is that the Lexington Council, a temporary moratorium on data center development. Can you tell us a little bit about how that affects the more ongoing effort to do those things you started to describe to account for energy use, water use, noise, air pollution, things like that?
Coincidentally, in relation to the data centers and what you've been hearing most recently about the announcement by one company of having purchased property to have a data center here in Lexington.
At the Lexmark campus.
Correct. Back in 2023, when the Urban County Council asked for an expansion of the urban service boundary, we adopted urban growth areas in 2024. And part of that master plan recommended that there be a small area plan for the Blue Sky Rural Activity Center, because when the urban service boundary expanded, it captured the Blue Sky Rural Activity Center. I would say making it no longer a rural activity center because it's within the boundary. But that is a developed area. So the thought was you need a small area plan for what is not greenfield. It's an already developed area. Coming out of that, we've been doing that plan for the past year. Part of that plan recommends or will recommend that there be modernization of the industrial code in industrial zones for Lexington, which has not happened since the 80s. Part of that proposal for modernizing industrial zones includes some language about data centers. That's part of the modernization of that. During that, or on the cusp of it, this announcement of the data center comes along. And so the council decided to do a moratorium. Moratoria are designed to give a community a little bit of time to examine a particular issue, to decide how should we regulate this land use. Not that moratoria only ever apply to land use, but in this particular instance, it's about land use. Then they also initiated a zoning ordinance text amendment, which is the method by which you amend the zoning ordinance related to land use regulations that specific to data centers. So what will happen immediately is that draft ZODA for modernizing industrial zones, we will separate the data center part because that will proceed immediately since the council initiated that and just address data centers. But meanwhile, after the Blue Sky Small Area Plan is adopted by the Planning Commission, that other part of the industrial zones ZODA, Zoning Ordinance Text Amendment, will proceed, but the data centers will be proceeding separately.
Would it discourage development of anything larger than this plan that's already proposed for the Lexmark campus?
That question is kind of ahead of the game in terms of a Zoning Ordinance Text Amendment process goes through a review process, both at the staff level and then with the Planning Commission. The council having initiated this, the Planning Commission only has 60 days to come up with the zoning ordinance text for this amendment. So the staff now will be working on that, making the final tweaks, edits, et cetera, to it. And I would anticipate that that particular draft of data center ZODA will be available in short order because we're on such a tight time frame for it. I don't know that I would use the word discourage. Obviously, zoning regulations focus on land use and both the appropriate land use for particular zones, but also the impact on the land.
I wanted to ask you about the limit on the square footage of 50,000 square feet. What's the significance of that?
It relates to, I would say, in these early stages, to both the amount of land required for that type of use, but also the intensity of the use, whether it's with electricity, water, whatever is necessary for such a facility. In other zones and other uses, it relates to all those things as well as sewer capacities and things like that. So I think maybe that's the relevance of the square footage limitation.
We know that these facilities consume a lot of electricity and they consume a lot of water. So the square footage, though, is that the best metric to use instead of, say, megawatts of electricity?
Recognizing that at least I am new to this regulation of data centers, other than what I have read, there's only certain avenues that a city, through its planning commission and through its zoning regulations, have for those types of regulations. Electricity isn't typically one that local governments regulate.
That makes sense. Another thing about the Lexmark site, Dart Points purchased the site for, I think, roughly $29 million or something like that. I saw that there's actually a minority neighborhood nearby. What are some of the things that the communities can do to ensure that the impact of these facilities doesn't disproportionately fall on disadvantaged communities?
The best thing I can tell you right now is as this ZODA related to data centers makes its way through the process, the Planning Commission will have a public hearing on the text of that ZODA, and people can come to the meeting and they can make public comment. But they can also submit written comment at any point during this process. Like I said, we've got a 60-day time limit with the Planning Commission. So as this starts getting introduced in front of the Planning Commission, there may be other discussions, but there will be an actual public hearing on the ZODA. So I would encourage people, if they have concerns, comments, et cetera, come to the meeting, make them at the meeting, or submit them. You can do it through the the Lexington City website, and you can submit written comments anytime you want to.
Another common attribute, based on my understanding of data centers, another common attribute that they have is on-site backup generation, often in the form of diesel generators. And they're not supposed to be running all the time. But of course, there could be cases where they do need to run. Obviously, that has noise impacts, that has air quality impacts. You know, what sort of thought goes into that?
I don't think it would be unusual for regulations, land use regulations around or involving data centers would include things like noise levels, and try to address those types of things in the land use regulations.
In terms of water consumption, is that something that the regulations we're talking about can also address?
Again, local government has a difficult time addressing water consumption. We do have an easier time addressing water waste, sanitary sewers, storm sewers, et cetera. And any use or development has to have the sewer capacity and a water quality sign off in order to operate.
In recent days, we've also heard about a fairly large potential data center development coming to Northeast Kentucky. TerraWulf is that company. And the reaction from some of the local leaders, anyway, has been a little bit of surprise. You know, they didn't really necessarily know that this was in the works. Are there questions that local officials should be asking? Are there things that they should anticipate when something like this happens?
I would like to say that as a general rule, when someone is coming to the community, Lexington, that there are people, developers, companies reaching out to discuss it with the city or with Commerce Lexington or some component of the city. And so I would hope that that would happen. It doesn't always happen. And it may be that the first time you hear about something is through some sort of press release. That's really not best for anybody, whether it's a company, whether it's the community, that the first time that the government may be hearing something is, you're bringing what to Lexington?
Are there any other things that we should keep in mind? Because this is going to go on for the foreseeable future. Yeah.
Give us time. Look for the draft when it comes out. Go through it. Like I said, people are free to make comment on it. And I really don't know what to tell you to expect until those drafts are finalized. But they are designed to address data centers. And whether or not, I don't know that yet, I don't know enough that I would ever describe them as discouraging. But they can be limiting in some capacity. And I think that's part of what people may be looking for. What is the scale of these things? How do we try to limit the impact, the size, those kinds of issues? And if those are the issues that people have concerns about, they should voice them in some capacity.
Well, thank you, Keith.
You're very welcome.
WEKU's Curtis Tate with Lexington Planning Commissioner Keith Horn. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. Jim Branscombe is a former staff member at the Appalachian Regional Commission, retired managing director of Standard & Poor's, and a former journalist whose articles have appeared in the Washington Post, the New York Times, Business Week, the Kentucky Lantern, and the Mountain Eagle of Whitesburg. And in an April 11, 2026 article, Changing the Names on the Deeds, the Case for an Appalachian Homestead Act, he argues that Central Appalachia's crisis is rooted in land ownership, not simply poverty or infrastructure, and proposes an Appalachian Homestead Act as a potential solution. Jim Branscombe, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thanks.
And so you begin with a striking premise here, that a century of federal investment in Central Appalachia has treated symptoms rather than causes. What, in your view, is the cause that policymakers have been unwilling or unable to confront?
They've taken the approach that either the people are the problem or the highways are the problem. If you look at the Appalachian Regional Commission investments, which started in 1965, approximately $30 billion total across 13 Appalachian states, 420-some counties. And the net result was we're left today with, one of the poorest congressional districts in the United States, Al Rogers' district, and several of the counties in Eastern Kentucky are among the poorest counties in the U.S. So basically, despite some good things that have happened with federal investments, relative to the nation, we're nowhere close to where we should be. And it's basically because it's a one-dimensional economy that was established in the mountains. And nothing was done with the demise of the coal industry to create an alternative economic situation. So that's what we're left with. And in every community that I've been in Central Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky, Southwest Virginia, Southern West Virginia, you know, there are all sorts of green shoots of people doing things. But what I think is missing, Tom, is that we don't have an overall vision of what has to change. President Johnson, when he signed the Appalachian Regional Commission legislation in 1965, said he was going to launch Appalachia on the bright highway of hope, and we just aren't out on the bright highway of hope currently. So I proposed something, I think, with a larger vision of what has to happen, and the Appalachian Homestead Act is one piece of that.
Well, the title of your piece is Changing the Names on the Deeds. Why is ownership of land so central to the future of Appalachia?
It's an issue of self-determination. You know, when economists and historians study why it is that South America has never been as prosperous as North America, one of the things they note is that Mexico and many of the South American countries have never done land reform. You know, owning land is a critical piece of self-determination. You know, some people may remember the movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Del Mar tells his brothers that if you ain't got land, you ain't no kind of man. And one of his brothers says, are you going to start a family? And Del Mar says, you can't discuss starting a family until you get your land back. So he was going to go down to the Indianola Savings and Loan and get the family farm back from foreclosure. And I think that's the basic spirit of it. The situation in Eastern Kentucky and across the Central Appalachian coalfields is basically that some of the best land, the high ground, the still forested land, the land that does not flood is owned by coal and timber companies. A good example is of the density of it all is Wise County, which is just over the mountains from Pine Mountain in Kentucky. 45% of the land surface of Wise County is owned by just two corporations, Penn Virginia and Heartwood Land and Trust. And when you try to figure out what you do to solve a situation like we had in the summer of 2022, when 45 people were killed by the flooding, you discover there's no place for the people to go. They don't have the land in which to build a new home. And while it's not a Homestead Act, Governor Beshear's high ground communities, eight of them across three or four counties in Eastern Kentucky, is a good example of what can happen if you can get access to the land to give people an option to move somewhere where they're not going to flood out again. Basically, the situation in East Kentucky is pretty easy to describe. The coal companies own 15% of the whole land surface of Eastern Kentucky. And in many of the counties, it's 40%. And they own 60 to 80% of the minerals underneath there. And the history is, that the landowner has minority rights to their own property. When strip mining first started early in the 1960s in Knott County, landowners were shocked to learn that bulldozers were on their property pushing the overburden across down the mountains, and they didn't have permission. And the Ritchie family hired Harry Caudill of Whitesburg to take a lawsuit to the Kentucky Supreme Court and get the broad form deed invalidated. And the Kentucky Supreme Court upheld the broad form deed. And it wasn't until 1988, through a amendment process, Amendment 2, that Kentucky finally, the citizens of the state of Kentucky said that's an injustice. So we have a long history of people feeling like they're minority people in the ownership of their own properties.
How do you propose that these lands be transferred from coal corporations or timber interests, and to whom?
It's pretty simple, really. If we go back to the Homestead Act of 1862, which was signed by President Lincoln, the Homestead Act operated from 1862 to the 1970s in the U.S., actually through the 1980s, state of Alaska. And basically what it allowed was for people who were willing to make a commitment to stay at least 5 years. They were given and developed the property. They were they had the rights to 5 to 40 acres. And what I would propose to do is on the coal lands that are in bankruptcy, and there's quite a few of them that are in bankruptcy now, I would propose that the federal government and the state governments combine, go in and buy up these properties. And to correct some of the problems that developed with the original Homestead Act, I would establish land banks that would buy the property and then transfer the property to land trust. And while those two things may sound complicated, Kentucky actually has legislation in effect that allows both of those entities to operate. There's a land bank operating in Louisville, for example, that buys up delinquent properties and puts them back on the market. And so all the Appalachian states have similar legislation. So we would buy up those properties and start distributing the properties back to people in the mountains.
So to put a fine point on it, these coal company bankruptcies and distressed land sales have created an opening to move forward on that.
It's a one-time opportunity that needs to be addressed before these lands end up being owned by a second generation of land speculators.
You referenced earlier the flood of 2022. And so one of the more urgent parts of your argument is about flooding and the need to move families out of low ground, very vulnerable hollers. And I'm wondering, how do floods in eastern Kentucky and southwest Virginia, for that matter, how do they change the conversation about land reform?
It requires a step back and a larger vision of what the major issues are. The Appalachian Regional Commission designated 30 counties in eastern Kentucky as ARC development counties. In 29 of those 30 counties, deaths are exceeding births. The only exception is in Whitley County, and the math there is the births are 16 ahead of the deaths. So we've got a depopulating eastern Kentucky, and we've got to find some way to change the dynamics of that. Even if you keep the young people who are moving out, you still have a problem because the math of what the demographers call natural decrease, the number of ambulances going to the graveyards rather than to the birthing centers, just means that we're in a death spiral population-wise and economic-wise. And when you are left with a population that's basically dependent on federal subsidies, federal paychecks, for example, in Harlan County right now, 57% of every dollar is coming from federal transfer payments, you know, black lung or disability or Social Security or food stamps. And to change that, we simply have got to come up with a much greater vision than the Appalachian Regional Commission had in 1965.
Well, some might hear the phrase land redistribution and immediately think this is politically impossible. And you argue that the idea has potential appeal across ideological lines. What do you think conservatives and progressives would each like about this proposal?
That's, you know, my view is that nothing is more American than homesteading. We distributed through the Homestead Act 270 million acres of America. 10% of the total land surface of America was distributed through the Homestead Act in the over 100 years that it was in effect. Conservatives can like it because owning property and self-determination are important to them. Progressives can like it because it meets their tests for justice, repayment for the sacrifices that the people in the mountains have made for the benefit of the rest of the American economy.
Would things like title clearing, assistance, legal aid, mediation, maybe adoption of stronger heirs' property protections, would things like those items need to come before any large-scale land transfer program?
Yes, that has to be done, Tom. If you think about it, the state of Kentucky used to be the state of Virginia, and clear title is a major issue. Both George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, as very young men, were surveyors in the state of Virginia. And, you know, they only did it for a short period of time. I think George Washington was only 17 years old when he started out as a surveyor. So in a nutshell, clear title is just not always straightforward in the mountains. And one of the things I have said has to happen in the Homestead Act that I would establish is that we would establish clear title, and we would have legal aid available to make sure that titles are clear and ownership is clear. Virginia operated under English common law. And under English common law, people may remember that the oldest son was the primogeniture was the inheritor of the property. If the under English common law, if the husband died intestate without a will, as my dad did in 1963, English common law said that the children inherited his property and the mother was left without anything. And that's what happened to us. And under the old terms, if one member of a family owning property decided to sell, then the mechanism was that would force this on court order that the property had to be put up for auction. And that actually happened to us in the about 2010. Luckily, my brother and I were able to buy the property back at auction. But those are some of the crazy things that are, you know, most folks would, conservatives and progressives would say are injustices that have to be corrected.
Mm-hmm. You frame the Appalachian Homestead Act not as a charity, but as repayment, a debt owed to a region that powered much of the country for decades. What would it mean, morally and practically, for the nation to take that debt seriously?
Well, I just did an article on looking at the value of what people of Eastern Kentucky and Southwestern Virginia have contributed. The major metallurgical coal seam that goes from Floyd County over through Letcher County is the Elkhorn seam. Bethlehem Steel was a major user of that coal. The Pocahontas seam is the equivalent in Southwest Virginia. It runs into these coal seams. You know, the BTU heat value is as high as 15,000. It's coking coal. And it's what built the steel mills, far the steel mills of the U.S. The value that I was able to compute from the geological records is somewhere between $400 million just in those two seams, all the way up to $1 trillion. So we're looking at $1 trillion of value that was contributed just from met coal, not steam coal, against $30 billion the Appalachian Regional Commission has invested. So it's a matter of equity. That value has not come back to the people of the mountains.
Jim Branscombe is author of the commentary, Changing the Names on the Deeds, the Case for an Appalachian Homestead Act. We've skimmed the surface in this conversation here, but we're going to place a link to the full article on our homepage at esweku.org. Jim Branscombe, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Tom.
In 1971, Branscombe published Annihilating the Hillbilly, a manifesto that argued that the stereotyping of Appalachian people was not folklore, but a tool. He spent the half century since documenting what happened next, and just published Annihilating the Hillbilly Redux, proposing that Eastern Kentucky's struggles are not the result of cultural failure or individual choice, but the predictable outcome of how institutions chose to operate in the region. Annihilating the Hillbilly Redux is now available wherever you get your books. Eastern Kentucky has suffered more than its fair share of natural disasters in recent years, flooding, tornadoes. In their latest book, Eastern Standard contributor, archaeologist, and author Chris Begley and co-author Amy Edelman offer insights about keeping you, your family, and your neighbors safe when disaster strikes. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thanks, Tom.
So the book opens with a kind of unlikely partnership. Amy coming from lifestyle and consumer culture, you coming from archaeology and wilderness survival. How did those two perspectives shape the tone and the usefulness of the book?
Well, Amy contacted me about writing this book, which she'd wanted to do for some time, after she read my previous book, The Next Apocalypse. And she liked some of the ways in which I focused on community, and it was not a fear-based approach to things going wrong. And I think she also liked the historical approach. And so in talking with her about doing this, one of the things we discussed a lot was the target audience. And for her, it was her friends who were educated and engaged, but just weren't preparing for anything that she thinks, and I think, is inevitable. And so she wanted something that would engage those people. Also, there's a large contingent of folks, I think, that are kind of turned off by the doomsday prepper, bunker and gun sort of discussion that you often see. That was something we wanted to avoid. So in this book, we tried to write it more in her voice, which, you know, was for me sort of a challenge at some point, and mainly I just tried to stay out of the way.
Well, you make a distinction between the doomsday stuff and thinking about practical preparedness, the inevitable disaster, as you mentioned. So how do you talk about serious threats, things like climate disasters or pandemics, civil unrest, without leaving people feeling overwhelmed by all that?
One of the first ways that we try to do that is to talk about it honestly. And while that might sound like it would be more serious, a lot of the discussion around disasters really plays up the fear in some of these extreme scenarios. For instance, one of the things you might imagine from reading a lot of the other literature is that you really need to look out for your neighbors when this happens, that people are going to be coming to get your stash of canned goods or whatever you have. That just doesn't seem to be the case historically. And so in order to sort of find that balance, we really try to talk about things plainly and honestly. This is what you can expect. This is what's happened in the past. Here are some reasonable scenarios.
You write about normalcy bias, the human tendency to kind of underestimate danger because we assume life will go on as usual. How does that bias show up in everyday life, and how can people push back against it?
Normalcy bias takes many forms. One of the ways that we often look at it is to think that things that have existed since we were children are just sort of the natural way of the world. And when you look back historically, you see that, in fact, things were much different in the not-too-distant past. One of the ways in which this normalcy bias play out is that we just can't believe something's happening. I mean, I think the thing that where that will resonate for most of us right now is with the political situation. We can't believe that this could represent some sort of threat, that the kinds of things we're seeing going on at the national level could actually be a threat to this thing that seems so natural and inevitable and long-lasting. But we know, of course, that that is the illusion.
Mm. Well, again and again, and you referred to this earlier, the book emphasizes community. Why do you argue that neighbors, local networks, and mutual aid are more important than stockpiles and isolation, that kind of thing?
One of the reasons for this focus on community is to think about sort of long-term recovery. Now, it's possible, I suppose, that you could accumulate enough food in your house and such to last a year or two. But if we're thinking about a large-scale disaster where something like the agricultural system collapses, we have to rebuild that. And we can't rebuild it by ourselves. We have to rebuild it as a community. And that's where this focus comes in. Or we can even look at these much more localized disasters, the floods in eastern Kentucky. Very few people got through that on their own. Very few people are recovering without the assistance of their neighbors and their community. And the reason that we need to emphasize this, although it sounds pretty obvious, is that the rhetoric that we hear about prepping for disasters often emphasizes the individual responsibility, individual readiness, your stockpile. That's not really what's going to get us through. In the course of recovering, it's going to involve compromises and it's going to involve getting along with other people. That's not easy to do. Sometimes it's harder than others. And that is something also that we probably should prepare for, developing a mindset that includes some sort of generosity and empathy and fairness and understanding.
Well, you recommend having two basic plans, one for sheltering in place and one for leaving quickly. What are the most common mistakes that people make in thinking through those two very, very different situations?
Well, I think one of the common mistakes people have thought about, although now largely people are trying to correct this, is that in the case of emergency, you grab your bug out bag with all your gear in it and you head out, I don't know, to the hills to sort of make your way outside of society, outside of civilization. That's just not realistic, of course. Somebody owns all of this property. There's, limited resources that we're going to, the kind that we're going to need. And so I think one of the misconceptions is that often staying put is going to be one of the important things. In terms of staying put, one of the important things to think about is what will you need and how much will you need and how are you going to store that or fit that in the place that you have to do that. Now, if you live on a sprawling, I don't know, farmstead in the countryside, that might not be an issue. But if you live in an apartment in an urban area, suddenly you have a whole other list of needs and constraints.
When will the book be available and where can it be found?
Publication date is June 23rd, and it should be everywhere that you get books or audiobooks or ebooks. And of course, on June 25th, you and I will be discussing this book, and I'll be signing it at Joseph Beth Booksellers here in Lexington.
What time is that happening?
That's 7 p.m.
7 p.m. All right. Chris Begley, co-author with Amy Edelman of the book The Emergency Playbook, A Bunker-Free Guide to Disaster Preparation. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps. You can stream all of our interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.